Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Where'd all the rental cars go? No, seriously, now that people are renting again, where did the cars go? A lot of them are sold off, and that's affecting pricing. We're going to talk about the car rental industry and how you can get your hands on one without selling a kidney. Personal finance writer Danielle Teo shares his tips. And we're going to talk to this author, William Green, about his book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, How the World's Greatest Investors Win in Markets and Life. One example, Laura Garrett's Green writes that in an industry overrun by alpha males, she fits none of the stereotypes of her profession. She's a true original who likens her nonlinear investment approach to the unconstrained poetic rhythms of free verse. When have I ever said that phrase? Never. We're also going to talk about interest rates. Okay, that's a little more simplistic, but it's a good conversation. Whatbank.ca is an online tool. They're a part of this whole rate aggregation world, and it's interesting to see how you get the best rates on things like savings accounts and GICs. We're also going to talk to an executive from Royal Bank on a tool they have called KnowMe Find and Save, which uses predictive technology to find money that you already have and automatically saves it for you. And we're also going to talk to Susan Desjardins from Dying with Dignity Canada on the importance of something that they call an advanced care plan. This is anything but depressing. I know I just used the word dying and I'm saying it's anything but depressing. I read through the workbook and I was completely excited about it. There's lots of great stuff in there. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. I have not rented a car in 1,000 years. I have barely driven a car in 1,000 years. As you can imagine, the pandemic has had a massive impact on the rental car industry. Hertz filed for bankruptcy, and many of the big agencies sold off a big portion of their fleets, leading in some places, leading to car shortages as volume starts to pick up again. So what does this mean for you? My next guest is here to talk about all that you need to know about renting a car in these crazy times. Personal finance and travel writer Daniel Teo joins me now. His work has appeared on CBC and BNN, as well as many other places. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, Bruce. Nice to be here. You know, I was planning a road trip down to the West Coast early last year before we were also rudely interrupted by the pandemic. And, you know, maybe you're planning on a trip through the Rockies or camping through the Maritimes. That was one of my favorite childhood memories. But road tripping is such a fundamental part to our Canadian experience. Let me ask you real quick. I know you just mentioned that you haven't rented a car in a while, but do you have a favorite road trip memory by any chance?
Oh my gosh. I love. So it's funny because I looked at an estimate for a car rental in Calgary because Alberta is the most extraordinary place. I think one of the most extraordinary places in the world to do a road trip with the Icefields Parkway and the mountains. It's all spectacular. So I would say the Icefields Parkway and anywhere around Kananaskis, the Bow Valley, you name it.
That's fantastic. And even if you were to rent a car right now for a quick weekend out of town, maybe your annual drive to Florida, if that's still allowed, that whole process is going to look a little bit different this summer. Don't get caught by surprise if a rental runs you something like $300 a day instead of your average, like say $50 for an economy car. What happened to the rental car industry was that when the pandemic hit, really like the rest of the travel industry, they had to face pandemic lockdowns, travel restrictions, and the general anxiety of and uncertainty of not knowing what comes next, like the rest of us. So like the rest of us at home, they had to adapt to survive. They tightened up their belts. And like you mentioned, there were massive cost reductions in staff, location closures, fleet reductions. I mean, Hertz itself, they dumped 40% of their inventory into the used car market. Budget Avis, they sold off over 200,000 of their cars. That didn't even save them from bankruptcy. Like in Hertz's case, that's a 100-year-old company caught off guard because of unforeseen circumstances.
What are you seeing in terms of pricing? So I mentioned that I looked up a car rental in Calgary this summer. The price was like $700 for the week. Is this more, less, or about the same as what I would have paid 2 years ago?
It'll definitely be more than what you paid 2 years ago, that's for sure. And really what we're going to see is an impending car rental apocalypse, if you will. I don't know about you, Bruce, but my wanderlust at this point is more like a wander desperation. And all that pent up demand, I don't know if you can call it a pent up demand chicken, but that's coming home to roost.
Yeah.
I mean, on one hand,
it's a lot of metaphors you're dealing with there. It's a lot of metaphors.
Yes. Yes, it is. But I mean, it's the reality of where we are. It's just all over the place. On one hand, you've got vaccines that are on the rise, some are around the corner. And I'll throw another one out there. It's going to be like a rush for toilet paper all over again. Everyone's just going to be itching to get on the road and out from where they are.
How long do you see this disconnect between supply and demand lasting?
It's going to take a little bit of time. Right now, because of all that demand and even the fleet reductions, that means something like right now, maybe one of every three rental cars in the market or in service are just no longer there. And even if the rental car companies want to build their inventories back up, there are production shortages. The car industry, they can't get their hands on enough microchips. That means they can't, these car rental companies, they can't make or they can't buy them fast enough.
So what are your tips for someone looking to get a rental car and not pay $1 million for it?
If you need to get a rental car this season, you'll need to strategize well in advance. Don't just show up and expect everything to go smoothly. If you do, you'll pay through the nose, you'll have really little selection, and you'll probably have to wait a while. Here are three things I think that you can do to help make this experience a little bit more bearable. First thing always is plan ahead. Book way early, at least 10 days in advance, maybe even when you're booking a flight. Do that right up front. And maybe get a little bit creative, right? You don't need to look at the airport locations. Those usually, you know, the stock runs out, dries up really fast, but maybe a local neighborhood, maybe 15, 20 minutes away from the airport, might have the inventory at a cheaper price. Mm. So check that out, plan ahead. And even then, you know what they say about the best laid plans? One of the things that you might want to take a look at is unconventional alternatives.
What does that mean? Typically, like rickshaws, scooters?
You know what? Public
transportation,
rideshare. Hey, that's, you know what? At one point in India, I actually drove a rickshaw around for the driver because I wanted to see what it was like. So that was really fun.
Fantastic.
But you're right. Public transportation, rideshare, bike shares. That's one way to get around. Unconventional, to be sure. But in this digital age, we've got lots of new services that can provide the same level of service. For example, Turo.com, basically, if I was to describe it, it's like Airbnb for cars. People out there, they've got vehicles that are sitting. You can go book one, meet with them to pick it up, rent it like you would regularly, and then drop it off. Hmm. You can do that with RVs as well. There's other services like Outdoorsy. If you're looking to get out into the great outdoors, same thing, same idea, Airbnb for RVs. There's plenty of opportunities out there to get out.
What's your go-to website? Because when I did my little internet search there, I mean, there's a lot of ads, of course, and then there's a site that I was familiar with, but I didn't price compare. Like I didn't look at, you know, five car rental aggregators. Do you have a favorite site?
I will try all the aggregators just to see what the available options are out there. I'm a big fan of shopping around just to keep the options and opportunities open. But I guess one of the ones, if anything, that I go back to, maybe it's cheating a little bit, but I'll typically check every time the Costco rental site.
Because Costco, like, no matter where I can get four rotisserie chickens for $10, a pair of jeans, and a lifetime supply of bath tissue.
That's exactly where. And you know what? My last trip to Hawaii, that's where we actually sorted out our rental with Costco, because they're everywhere and they give you preferred rates wherever you go as well.
I had no idea. I have learned so many things. Daniel, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you in the car rental lineup.
Fantastic. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Bruce.
Daniel Teo is a personal finance and travel writer. He's published all over the place, but our focus today was on the car rental market. What's going on and how you can score a ride without paying through the nose.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Whether you're saving for something in the short term or for the long term, you're probably going to want to put your money in a good place based on your needs. So maybe it's safety is your number one need. Maybe it's about a rate that's your number one need. But it's not super easy to keep track of all the different rates out there for all the different products from all the different banks. There is a site called whatbank.ca, and they're trying to help you stay informed about these rates here in Canada. Joining me now for more on this is Lawrence Pilch. He is with whatbank.ca. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. What does whatbank.ca do, and how does it work?
So it's a website that tracks the high interest saving rates that are available across Canada, as well as the 1 to 5 year GIC rates that are available. So we look at those every day, and with some beautiful interactive tables and graphs, we show you what's going on. But what's really unique is that you can enter your email address and say, notify me when this rate changes, or notify me when there's a new high interest savings rate or highest GIC rate. So you don't have to keep coming back, or you don't get emails like a newsletter once a week that you're not that interested in. You can just monitor banks and rates that you are interested in.
There are a lot of rate aggregator websites out there. I don't even need to list them, but there are a lot. How are you different?
So that is probably the biggest difference, the one that I mentioned just now, that we alert you. You say, here's what I'm interested in. We monitor it, and we send you an email when it changes. So if you are, you know, putting some money in EQ Bank or Tangerine for budgeting, for a vacation, for a car, for a house, you know, it's good to have a separate account because it's out of sight, out of mind. But it's not unmonitored. So it's out of mind. But if that bank suddenly drops their rate a lot, you know, you'll get an alert saying, you know, here's the new rate at that site. Go ahead.
Is it a particular temperament that shops so aggressively for rates? Because I look at the numbers here and think, why does that matter? I'm saving 10 grand for 3 years at 2%. If I got 2.5%, that's $150 over 3 years. That's $50 a year. That's my Domino's pizza order if I add the wings and the brownies. Is it really worth the work? Is it worth the mental space that it is going to take up in my brain for $50?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Here's how I like to think of it. We all save up for things that some are bigger than others. Some people save for houses, and those are hundreds of thousands of dollars for a down payment. And that's and the difference between a big bank base rate and one of the higher rates you can get is $1,500 a year. And so the way I like to think of that is, if you could design a lottery and it had one ticket and you happened to hold that ticket, you know, would you design that lottery? So it's a way, a risk-free way of awarding yourself the winnings of a lottery as long as you want for every year. So it's a free lunch, and there's very few of those in the world.
How much difference do you see in rates across the major banks and some of the smaller, you know, online ones? How big of a delta is there?
The RBC is at 0.05. And right now, at historically low interest rates, the best I can find is 1.55. So that's a 1.5% difference. And that's what I'm saying. If you have $100,000, you know, which is a lot, but if you're saving up for a house, you need that for a down payment. That's an extra $1,500 a year that, you know, you could just get.
Does your system allow you to see the amounts that people are talking about? Do you have a sense of that?
No, I do not.
Right. Because it's interesting. I think there probably are people who are doing the house savings and it's 100 grand, but then there's a lot of people for whom this is a sport. Like, they have a good time doing this.
Sure. There are people who chase rates. There's teaser rates. The big banks are good at teaser rates and very poor at maintaining rates. So they lure you in with a very high rate that's good for, you know, 30 or 60 days. and then it goes very low, thinking that you'll forget or you'll be lazy, you know, inertia, and you'll leave your money there. So I don't track the teaser rates. I don't really buy into that philosophy. I'm looking for, you know, ongoing rates that are higher than the big banks for the long term.
What's your model here? So for the big rate aggregators, the established ones, it's typically an affiliate fee. So when someone clicks on the account at a particular institution, they get X dollars if an account is opened. How do you keep the lights on?
Yeah. So, you know, early days here, Bruce, we've been out for about a month or two. I'm trying to avoid that affiliate model because it's very difficult to be completely unbiased. If that's, you know, where the money's coming from, the people who you're promoting. But you know, I'm hoping to get enough traction that that people, you know, people who are saving have money to buy electronics, to buy shoes, to travel. I mean, they have money, right? They just don't have money for financial services, right? So that's the
are you there. Are you hoping then to sell like banner advertising on the website?
Some type of sponsored content.
Is this a hobby for you? I ask because listen, I think you've got a major differentiator. If you're not trying to make money, then you've got a big differentiator that you haven't spoken about, because you can claim with some credibility objectivity.
Sure, but you can claim the objectivity. Like I do really believe that it's very difficult to be unbiased and objective if you're getting paid by the people that you're talking about on your site. That's why there's the whole thing in medicine that doctors shouldn't be paid by pharmaceutical companies to recommend drugs, because it's you know, people are human and they're not Spock. They can't be completely unbiased. So that's really important to me, to be known as a trusted, unbiased site.
Do you need this site to generate the revenue to pay your mortgage?
No, but I'd like it to pay its own cost.
Right. Okay. Very interesting stuff. Well, Lawrence, I really appreciate you providing some context on whatbank.ca. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Lawrence Pilch is the founder of whatbank.ca. It's a, you know, it compares rates across product and across institutions. But what we just learned from Lawrence is that he doesn't operate from the traditional, you know, referral fee model. So he would say there's a level of objectivity that arises because of how that's structured. Well, stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, saving money with predictive technology. We're going to focus on Nomi Find and Save. It's an app from RBC. Peter Tilton is our guest. And later, we're going to talk to William Green about his book. It is called Richer, Wiser, and Happier: How the World's Greatest Investors Win in Markets and Life.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. The banks know a lot about us. They know how much money we make, how much we spend, where we spend it. Of course, they and every other marketer on the planet uses that data to sell us stuff. Of course they do. But what if they could use that data to help us save money too? That would be helpful. Royal Bank says it is trying to help you do that by using predictive technology that locates any extra dollars you've got kicking around and automatically saves them. It's called Nomi Find and Save, and Peter Tilton joins us now to talk about it. He's the Senior Vice President of Digital at RBC. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thank you for having me today.
How does Nomi Find and Save work?
That's a great question, Bruce. So Nomi Find and Save, it's a digital savings account, and it uses artificial intelligence predictive technology to understand our clients' transaction patterns, and it finds extra dollars in their cash flow and automatically moves it to savings. So it's really intelligent sort of capability that helps our clients save, even when they think they may not be able to. Since we've launched it in 2017, it's helped our clients save more than $1 billion in total, which is about $389 a month or $4,500 a year roughly. So it's basically doing a cash flow forecast for all of the RBC customers who have Find and Save, and then predicting when they've got just a few, even a few cents, a few dollars extra, and squirrels it away every day, sometimes multiple times a day, whenever they have the surplus cash and the customer doesn't have to do a thing. It does it all for them.
What has your client feedback been on this? I mean, people know they're signing up for it, but surely some people look at their statements and are like, wait a second here. Who stole that $3.34?
Look, it is overwhelmingly positive. I've been a banker for over a quarter of a century, for as long as I can remember. I have never had the pleasure of experience about being associated with a product that has had such a profound impact in helping people and equally has been so positively received. In fact, the customers that use Nomi Find and Save, the stories that we hear, the net promoter scores that we get, they're more likely to predict RBC than anybody else. They will stay with us. And we hear these wonderful stories from customer testimonies of things like, you know, I was going to get married and I didn't think I'd be able to afford a wedding dress. And Nomi Find and Save has allowed them to do this. So I just squirrel away a little bit of money when they have it. So it's all on the mobile app. You can see it. It's completely transparent. And we really don't get any of that sort of customer feedback around where's the money gone. It's very, very simple to understand.
Can you give us some examples of what the AI is looking for? I assume it's things like, okay, here's the timing of your paycheck and you typically eat out, you know, three times a month. But give me more context on what the AI is analyzing.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's important to call out. So we've been talking about Find and Save predominantly today, but Nomi is an engine that works for three main services. It does the Find and Save to squirrel away savings, but it also does analytics across your sort of future and current spend to spot any sort of abnormalities or anything interesting, and it gives you nudges. And we've issued 1.5 billion nudges that we know our customers have seen. Now, part of my Australian accent, but that was billion, not million. And then it also is helping over 1 million Canadians with budgeting as well, AI-driven budgeting. So it does all of these things. So what it's basically doing, we've got this AI engine, which is learning transaction patterns of every single individual, which we couldn't do as human beings, as bankers, and then finds those extra dollars that, you know, if you weren't looking for, they might miss or might spend, and squirrels them away. So that is doing what you're suggesting, Bruce. So it is looking for, it understands what your common bill patterns are that are coming up. It knows when your cash flow is coming in, so when you're likely to get your pay, or maybe it's a welfare check, or whatever your income might be. And it balances it all out and figures out a safe to spend amount of money that it can put away into the savings account. Or if you're using the other tools like budgeting, it might give you some coaching or nudges that, hey, Peter, you're spending a lot more on takeaway food. You know, you wanted to sort of, you know, apply yourself a little bit more and set yourself a budget, and it helps to coach people as well. So it's quite a sophisticated little engine that we've got here.
You are the SVP for digital, and it's kind of like you're running an amazing fried chicken restaurant and a Weight Watchers franchise in the same location. And I say that because the Weight Watchers is savings. Yep, you're helping people save. But at the same time, you're a bank. You make money from people spending. You want them transacting on your card. So you're overseeing innovations on spending, which we want to be hard, and saving, which we want to be easy. How do you navigate that seemingly paradoxical notion?
Well, look, there's nothing more important taking outside that paradox is happy customers. And for customers know that we have their back, it drives loyalty and satisfaction. And it means that these customers want to stay with RBC and they want to introduce us to their friends and their family. And we're seeing a lot of that with this Find and Save capabilities. In terms of your question around managing spend versus savings, there is nothing more important than helping Canadians start on their financial journey. And the thing that I love being associated with this product is that we're seeing for around about a quarter to a third of customers that this is their first ever savings account. So we've got 230,000 clients using Nomi Find and Save. And on average, we're seeing them increase from saving $34 a month prior to the pandemic to about $57 a month during the pandemic. So these are, let me get those numbers correct. That's their withdrawals increase, but they've increased their savings from $260 to $413 a month on average, which is really interesting. So what we're doing is we're helping savings, but we're really the most important thing is helping Canadians with learning the practice of savings. And for these Canadians that have never, may have never had a savings account, and this is their first ever go at it, as a banker, there is nothing more important than helping them start that journey and learn that they can save and learn that they can squirrel away, that amount of money. That $400 a month is a lot of people for many people, particularly if you've never had that savings practice.
So
it helps them sort of set a goal.
I read a whole bunch of the online comments, lots of positives. I hardly knew it took out the money. Awesome, awesome, awesome. And some negatives. So one of the criticisms was I wasn't able to turn it off or pause it. How do you pause it? Do you just dunk your phone in boiling water? Is that how you do it?
No, look, you can certainly turn it off in the mobile app and you can pause it. There is a pause capability to do there. So the customer might have had a challenge in locating it, but that is not something we hear very commonly. It does have the function of the mobile app to be able to pause.
What is the prompt to do something with the money that's been saved? Like how do you, a wedding dress is a very different goal than a house down payment is a different goal than retirement savings. So how do you guide the client to a vehicle that is going to be most appropriate for the savings? So savings account versus a TFSA versus, investing for retirement in a low cost ETF.
Look, for this product, it is a very simple savings mechanism. We're just trying to get customers into the practice about savings. So we've chosen not to get into that sort of investment continuum conversation around, are you better off with GIC or should be putting this into a robo product or should you be keeping in savings? It is designed as a cash flow, putting aside, squirreling cash into a cash account. And we've kept it super, super simple as that entry level savings product. So what is very encouraging as this product is getting a bit more mature and we're seeing more and more customers use it, is it does tend to turn into a conversation about, hey, Bruce, I've saved, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 in Find and Save. And that's when they will typically talk to the bank around, take a little bit of advice. Maybe I should open a GIC. Maybe I should think about opening a mutual fund. So that tends to come as a more mature product. So this one, I would describe it's almost like the G1 license for savings. You haven't really saved before, or you just need some help in saving to get some cash flow positive, and that's what its role is. We've decided to keep it super, super simple. So it's two clicks to open. You don't think about choices. You don't have to do your financial plans, and you can just get started and get going. And in my mind, I think that was the right decision because it's helping so many people.
Really interesting stuff. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me, Bruce.
Peter Tilton is Senior Vice President of Digital at RBC. He was here to talk to us about their app. It is called Nomi Find and Save.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, we'll talk to William Green about his book, Richer, Wiser, Happier: How the World's Greatest Investors Win in Markets and Life. But first, Susan Desjardins from Dying with Dignity Canada is here to talk about advanced care planning. Don't touch that dial. Stick around. I promise it will be interesting and it will be fun. If anyone can make it fun, it's me. It's me. If that is not enough moolala for you, our website has all of our past episodes, very easily searchable. Go to moolala.ca. There's a search button on the podcast page. Go by topic. You can also go to all of the podcast platforms and download. I think we've got like 500 episodes on there. It's ridiculous. So, well, there's your summer. Spotify, Stitcher, Amazing Prime, tune in. While you're there, subscribe, write us a review. Wouldn't that be nice?
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I like insurance. I feel better knowing that I have insurance. I hope I won't get into a car accident, but if I do, I'm insured. It's still going to be scary and, you know, it's going to be all that, but I know that I've done what I can do to mitigate the downside if I do have an accident. You can actually do the same thing when it comes to the end of your life. We have talked about estate planning and end-of-life care and all that stuff a lot on this show, but I just found a really great resource that I wanted to share. It is called the Advanced Care Planning Kit, and it comes from Dying with Dignity Canada. And we're going to talk about it. Susan Desjardins is a board member with Dying with Dignity Canada. She joins us today from Victoria, BC. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Great to be here.
What is the essence of Dying with Dignity? What's the essence or the philosophy that people should have by way of context?
I would say when you boil it right down, our goal is to ensure that people don't have to endure unnecessary suffering at the end of life.
It's beautiful. And you know, I am blessed by having parents for whom this is an easy conversation to have. I know that isn't the case for all families where parents don't have an easy time talking about it with their kids, or kids don't have an easy time talking about it with their parents. But my mom flagged this resource. She said, take a look at this PDF. We got to talk about it. So people are going to go to your website. They're going to download this PDF. When they open it up, what will they find?
Well, they will find what I'd like to call a method of planning to ensure, as you talked about insurance, that you have in place what's needed in the event that you have a serious injury or an illness or are approaching end of life. Think of it as an umbrella that shelters your estate plan, which you mentioned, any financial preparation you might do, your healthcare documentation, and clear definitions of your own values and beliefs.
You include this, it's a great visual actually of an umbrella with all that you discussed. Some of them we've talked a ton about, like estate planning. Yep, got it. We have talked less, and I think in our culture, we talk less about values and beliefs. What sort of questions does one ask themselves or others to distill what those values and beliefs are?
We have found that oftentimes it's as simple as thinking about your end of life and what are the things that you fear the most and what are the things that are most important to you. So, for instance, do you fear unnecessary suffering? Do you fear not being able to communicate with your loved ones? What's important to you? Is autonomy and control important to you? Is volunteering important to you? Mm. Time with your loved ones. So we try and engage people in conversations and thinking about those kinds of things.
There's also a realm or a section under that umbrella called ongoing discussions. What ongoing discussions should we be having and how often?
Well, the main thing is you want to actually use the kit and be prepared to create what we call an advanced directive, which is a way of expressing your wishes with respect to healthcare, and you want to talk about those things with your loved ones. In particular, you want to discuss these issues with the person you appoint as your power attorney for personal care, or substitute decision maker, as it's also called, and also with, for instance, your family physician or healthcare team if you have certain healthcare issues that have involved you with a healthcare team. Mm-hmm.
You've got some tips here on how to get this done. And I love them because on the one hand, it's a PDF, fill it out, you're fine. On the other hand, it's a big project. There's a lot of emotional stuff that goes through it. So three that you've highlighted are a buddy system, bite-sized pieces, and rewards. I assume you mean chocolate. Tell me about those three tips and how they play into getting this done.
Well, I think your mother used the first tip really well, Bruce. Because she got in touch with you and said, you need to help me with this. Mm. So I think that's one of the things that is really important, because by doing that, she has engaged you in a conversation about what matters to her. And whether or not you're her substitute decision maker, that's really important that she feels she can talk to you about it. Mm. We would encourage someone like your mother to also discuss it with whoever is appointed as their substitute decision maker. And you can encourage people to think about this topic by reading some books, like the book called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande.
So just good.
To get into that mindset, right? Dividing it into manageable sections. Well, you know, thinking about your values takes some time and thought. And oftentimes it's hard for people to do that. So in some instances, you might want to get a group of like-minded friends together. Maybe it's your bridge club, who, like all of us, are perhaps getting a little older and want to talk about what they should be doing or planning for end of life. Mm. Chocolate, of course. You know, if you have the conversation with your bridge club, there has to be chocolate cake afterwards.
100%. 100%. 100%. Now, I want to ask you about something else that you include in the PDF. It's called the Clinical Frailty Scale. And it's a little terrifying, but it's also really helpful. How do you believe people should use it or think about it?
Well, the main thing here is that as you're preparing your advance directive and thinking about these things, you want to give some consideration to your own health conditions and what the implications of them might be. So you want to ask yourself some questions about your health conditions that'll better prepare you for the advance care directive. For instance, do you have chronic health conditions that might affect how your life evolves? Do you have a potentially life-threatening or life-ending condition right now? Are you aging? And this is where the frailty scale comes in. And perhaps you're becoming less capable of doing certain things with respect to your day-to-day care. You want to consider all those things. And the frailty scale is simply a tool to help you consider where you might be in terms of your own health condition.
What I found so great about it was it's an acknowledgement that if we're still alive, like we're still living and breathing and alive, we are going to become increasingly frail over time. It's the way that the human physiology works. It's not bad. It's not good. It just is. And I thought that was a really refreshing bit of honesty.
Yeah, it really is. You know, we're all getting a little bit older, and of course we're doing what we can to try and stay as healthy as possible, both physically and mentally. But as you say, it's sort of inevitable. So yeah, you might as well face it and take the appropriate action.
Physically, mentally, and aesthetically, like a whole round of like the Botox and the surgery. I'm dyeing my hair. I'm kidding. I'm not doing any of those things. Let me ask you this. One of the things in the zeitgeist right now is MAID, medically assisted dying. That is something that we're seeing headlines about that is worthy of conversation as a part of this. How does this process factor in those conversations?
So as you say, it's certainly been in the news recently. And as we know from various surveys, Canadians are very interested and very supportive of having a choice at end of life. So in the preparation of your advanced care plan and your advanced directive, the main focus is on your wishes and your beliefs. And in the event that you find yourself in, let's say, a particular healthcare situation, what care you would want or not want. So that's the focus of it. But that also leads us to the issue of, if you find yourself in a healthcare situation where you may be facing a life-threatening or life-ending illness, you may not want to suffer unnecessarily. Let's say if you're at a point where treatment is not going to make a difference to the end outcome. And although only you as an individual can make a request for assisted dying, no one else can do that. No one else can authorize it. We are encouraging people to, if they feel that this is something that they might want in the future, given certain circumstances, to document that information and include it with the advance directive. It's more information for your substitute decision maker about what your wishes are. It's something that we are finding now lawyers are willing to include for people in their overall documentation, including their will and their advance directive. And in the future, it might help to have your wishes respected if, for instance, we get to a point where individuals are permitted to make an advance request for an assisted death.
So the process is consider, decide, document, and review. Having been in this world, you've been associated with Dying with Dignity for a long period of time. What would you say in that process is the hardest part or the one people get stuck on the most? Is it just getting started or is it taking this process through to the finish?
I would say it's probably more the getting started. Mm. Because as you mentioned, this is not a topic that people are very comfortable thinking about. No one wants to think about a loved one dying. It's not where we want to be. But we've also found that people feel much more comfortable when they've had these conversations with their loved ones. Mm. They feel more secure that their healthcare provider understands what they wish their wishes are. And what they effectively are doing is unburdening the loved ones mm-hmm. who might have to be considering decisions around their person's healthcare, their parent or their brother or their, whoever it might be, and not be sure what that person wanted. So by doing this, you are able to clarify what you feel you would want in given circumstances and relieve your loved ones of that burden. Mm-hmm.
Susan, thank you for joining us to talk about this. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Bruce.
Susan Desjardins is a board member with Dying with Dignity Canada, and she was here to talk about something called the Advanced Care Planning Kit. If you go to their website, you can download it. It's a PDF. It's a really easy read. It's a very practical approach. There's some work to do, but you will be glad that you did it. Stay with us. Coming up next, William Green takes us through his book, Richer, Wiser, Happier: How the World's Greatest Investors Win in Markets and Life. Here's another thing to check out. So I do this show called Cityline. It is a daily lifestyle TV show on air across North America. And we talk about lots of different things on the show, but I talk about money. So if you go to cityline.tv, search for me, you're going to find a bunch of stuff that I have done. To keep up to date on Cityline and my columns for CBC Radio and BNN Bloomberg, here's what you do. You sign up for our newsletter. Comes once a month. That's it. And I also reference segments from this show and how to find this show on all the different podcast platforms and all that. Go to moolala.ca to sign up for the newsletter once a month. I won't do anything else with your email address.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you want to be the best, It helps to learn from the best. The same could be said for investing. Author William Green did all the hard work compiling the best of the best over 25 years. He spent many, many, many hours interviewing some of the world's best investors. And he joins us now to talk about his book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, How the World's Greatest Investors Win in Markets and Life. Hello there.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here with you. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. Where did this obsession start with learning about and from the world's greatest investors?
Well, in a strange way, it went back actually to my childhood when I was about 15 and started gambling on horses. And I think I had this fantasy then that there were neat ways to make money without actually getting your hands very dirty. And that didn't work out too well. But then when I guess I was in my early 20s, I discovered the stock market and I thought, this is the real game. And so really it was kind of born of my laziness and indolence that I didn't really want to actually do any serious work. And so I had this fantasy that there were these areas of life where if you just thought better than other people, you could do really well. But I had this kind of unfair advantage, which was that I actually, as a journalist, had the opportunity to interview the greatest investors. And so I started just to interview a lot of them for magazines like Forbes and Fortune and Money and later Time, where I was an editor. And gradually my obsession kind of matured, I guess. And I started to think, oh, well, these guys aren't actually just extraordinary gamblers. They're not just lining their pockets brilliantly without working too hard. They're actually incredible thinkers. Mm-hmm. And that I think was when I started to realize, oh, there's something going on here that's actually really interesting, because if you can learn to think better, not only in markets, but in life, it's just such an extraordinary advantage.
We know about Warren Buffett. We know about Stephen Schwarzman. What is a lesser known investor that you think we should know about, and what should we know about them?
Well, one of the most fascinating investors I write about, and actually the very first person I arranged to interview and travel with when I started working on this book 5 years ago, is a guy called Monish Pabrai, who basically in about 1994 discovers Buffett and decides that if Buffett could average, I think it was 31% over 45 years, 31% a year, he thought, well, it shouldn't be too hard for me to figure out how to average, say, 26% a year. And so he figured out he had $1 million saved at that point. And he said, okay, so if I play this 30-year game and I can average 26% a year, I can turn $1 million into $1 billion. And so my first chapter is really about how he set about doing that by reverse engineering Buffett and his genius 97-year-old partner, Charlie Munger. And he basically discovers that Buffett and Munger had essentially revealed the laws of investing. And he was stunned to think that not many people, including many professional money managers, were actually bothering to play the game the way the greatest investors of all were playing it. And so that for me becomes a really interesting way to look at what those fundamental laws of investing are and whether we also can replicate the approach of the greatest investors in order to become rich ourselves.
You include a female in this book, which, you know, there's a lot of dudes you talk about, but you do talk about a female named, is it Laura Garrett or Jarrett?
Yeah, Laura Garrett, who's remarkable. Yeah.
Well, I want to read a quote. You say, in an industry overrun by alpha males, many molded by the same elite business schools, Laura fits none of the stereotypes of her profession. She's a true original who likens her nonlinear investment approach to the unconstrained poetic rhythms of free verse. I want to meet her. She sounds amazing.
She's a really extraordinary person. And she unlike many of the men that you write about in the investment world, she's very humble, very quiet. She's kind of a diminutive, modest Midwesterner. And you look at her and you think, you know, oh, she's nothing. You know, you wouldn't be startled if you met her on the street. And what I came to realize is that she's kind of this warrior. I mean, the strength of mind that it took to come from this kind of rural background where she had no business education, no background. She had relatives who were factory workers and farmers and the like. And to come from that background and become an extraordinarily successful international investor, I think took such iron will, But what's really extraordinary about her also is that she's so international. It's incredible. So she spends maybe 9 months a year traveling. She'll plant herself in other countries. She'll just sort of say, oh, well, let me go live in Turkey for a few weeks or a few months. So there are all of these places where she's basically built a kind of informational advantage just by understanding these international markets way better than anyone else. And she's just a true original and a true intellectual. And so when everyone else was kind of hiding out during COVID, I said to her, so what have you done? And she very typically, she had holed up in a house with a stream and with about 45 books. And so she's just someone who's constantly building this intellectual and informational advantage, which I think is kind of revealing, because one of the great questions for any investor is well, do I have an edge, and what is that edge? And for her, to some degree, it's things like the fact that she speaks fluent Japanese, that she has a home in Kyoto, that she's reading constantly, traveling constantly, and so there's a sort of cumulative intellectual advantage that she has over other investors.
We've talked a lot on this show about gender in investing, and quite often how extraordinary the returns are for female investors versus men based on a bunch of things. Did you go there with her? Did you put the lens of gender on, or did you just say, you know what, it's all through the lens of investment returns and we don't need to go there?
No, we did talk about it, and I talked about it with other well-known female investors that I interviewed, and it's a very complex and an uncomfortable subject, and I don't feel hugely qualified to weigh in on it, but I'll repeat what she said to me, which is she said she has a lot of friends who were extraordinary investors, who were female peers in the industry, who would quit in their 40s because they were sort of sick of chest-thumping macho men who, you know, wanted their names on the covers of magazines. And I think it's very hard. It's an industry that's built on ego in many ways, right? It's there is a chest-thumping aspect to it. And I think it also requires a lot of compromise. She said that in her early days when she got a job at a very well-known fund company, she said there were just no female role models. And she said it was just clear that nobody had to really explain it to you, that it was clear that you had to get in at 6 a.m., 7 a.m. In the morning and leave at 8 p.m. and you had to work 7 days a week. And so she said if you wanted to have kids or you wanted to have a balanced life or a balanced family, you saw that there weren't very many role models.
Right.
And at a certain point, she decided if she wanted to compete with all the men in this industry, she couldn't have kids for a while. Mm. And then at a certain point, her husband decided, I'm not sure I want to. And then she said it just kind of got away from us and we didn't have time. And I asked her if that made her sad, that compromise. And she said, yeah, sometimes. But she said, I love my job. It's an intellectually thrilling job. And so I think the issue is just not an easy one. It's not simple, and there are structural problems in the industry. There are personal issues. There are ego issues. And as my son would say, it's above my pay grade.
Right. So your title is Richer, Wiser, Happier. I think it would seem to be quite easy to find richer and wiser together. But are the world's greatest investors actually happier?
I think they can give us really interesting clues as to what it takes to build a happy life. And one of the questions that I look at in the epilogue of the book, for example, is what does the money actually do for you? And I think they're an interesting group of people to ask about what money does for you, because in some ways they've hit the absolute jackpot, right? They have everything you could possibly dream of, you know, the yachts and the planes and all of that nonsense, which for many of them actually does turn out to be nonsense. And I think what was striking to me was that I think there are two great things that you get from the money. And the first, maybe more than that, but the first, I think, is that they're able to live in alignment with who they are in often in all of their peculiarity. I mean, they can set up their lives in a way so that they don't have to do any of the stuff they don't want to do. And I think that's a very powerful gift. And the second thing I would say pretty consistently is the ones I saw who were happiest are the ones who share the money in extraordinary ways. And so Monish Pabrai, the person I spoke about earlier, who decided that he was just going to reverse engineer Buffett, his game is basically to make $1 billion and then to give it away. And so he's already educated thousands of kids across India who are very high IQ kids from extremely poor families. And he set up this charity that that identifies these extraordinarily talented kids and gives them 2 years of free education to get them into the Indian equivalent of MIT. And so he's literally helped to lift thousands of families out of poverty. And so when I see someone like that, Monish, in a way, is a good example of someone who lives deeply in alignment with who he is. He's perfectly prepared to turn away millions of dollars of a year in fees so that he doesn't have to do stuff that he doesn't want to do. And at the same time gives away money in a way that I think is very fulfilling and satisfying and life enriching for him.
Well, this has been a fulfilling conversation, William. Thank you for joining us for it.
Thank you. It's been a delight chatting with you.
William Green is the author of Richer, Wiser, Happier, How the World's Greatest Investors Win in Markets and in Life. I don't say this a lot, but it's a really well-written book. There's a lot of not great books written about investing and investors. This one's really good, so you should find it and read it. That is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. A note on how to keep up on all things Moolala. It's very simple. There's a newsletter available at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this show, which goes on all the podcast platforms after you hear it on SiriusXM. And if you'd like to send us some feedback, some comments, some questions, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.